Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from the relator in Perry Holmes versus Patterson.
May it please the court, Mr. John Mark, in the argument for the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Your Honor. The issue in this case is whether a defendant should be required to disclose private, confidential financial information in every case where an allegation of entitlement to punitive damages has been made, or whether a plaintiff should be required to establish a prima facie case of entitlement, either by jury verdict or otherwise, before the plaintiff is allowed discovery on net worth.
What would otherwise be?
Excuse me.
What would otherwise be?
Ma'am?
What would otherwise be?
Otherwise would be something like the Wyoming plan, which I was discussing. Perry's position in this case is that a plaintiff should be required to make that prima facie showing. The reasons for that is, first of all, financial information is private and confidential in nature, and I think that's been judicially accepted by courts across the country for many years.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
About that. One of the arguments concerning the confidentiality as far as your particular client is concerned, mm-hmm, is because the information may be disclosed or learned by competitors, and that's why it's important for you to have mandamus written, correct?
Yes, sir.
Would then this test not apply if we were dealing with individuals who don't have to worry about competitors but merely have a concern about having significant private information about their concern, but there is no real impact to their lives like there would be, for instance, to you because of a competitor?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that, of course, in my situation, my client has a reason for competitors not to know what their financial status is. But beyond that, I think that there is a strong feeling and belief that financial information of all kinds, from private individuals, whether they be doctors, whether they be whoever they are, that information is private and confidential to them.
All right. Would we, in essence, be coming up with a rule that arguably could be extended to allow for mandamus relief whenever discovery is requesting information that falls within, say, a realm of privacy? In other words, what if you were involved in a lawsuit and you were issued discovery that asked for something, not tax returns, but something else of an equally private nature that you didn't want to have disclosed, something maybe concerning your medical background, who knows what it may be, and you wouldn't want that disclosed? Could you then go down and seek mandamus relief that would be sustained because of that?
Well, Your Honor, the only way I can answer that at this point is that I'm focusing now on financial information. And with respect to financial information, I think that the cases are fairly clear that that is private, confidential information that people don't like to have disclosed. Now, when it comes to medical information is disclosed in cases all the time if there is an issue in the case relating to that medical condition. In this case, you have a situation where there is relevance with respect to financial condition of Perry, but only on issues that deal with the bifurcated part of the trial or the punishment phase of the trial. So until the plaintiff makes the burden of having established that he has a right to punitive damages by making a prima facie case of gross negligence or malice or whatever, that information is not even relevant.
We bring up another concern, and that is irrelevancy. Are we to fashion a rule such that whenever a trial court requires someone to produce something, or party to produce something that would be irrelevant, would they then be entitled to mandamus relief? Did I say that would be irrelevant? Would they be entitled to mandamus relief?
Well, I guess it depends on what it is, Your Honor. If it's financial information in this context, I would not think so. I wouldn't think so. But in this particular context, with respect to financial information, the courts that have granted or decided, or the states that have decided that bifurcation is an appropriate way to deal with this issue of the introduction of net worth information to the jury, all of those states have also provided rules or promulgated rules that require the plaintiff to make some sort of prima facie showing of entitlement to those damages before that information is discoverable. So at least in this context, Your Honor, that we're talking about today, that certainly might entitle a person to mandamus relief, but if this court were to fashion a rule that requires a court to get that prima facie evidence from a plaintiff, either by affidavit or otherwise, before he allows the discovery of the net worth, that would take care of the situation.
At the time of Lunsford, our impression from the briefs that 42, 43 states, something like that, allowed this type of information. We were joining an overwhelming majority. I didn't see anything like that number in the brief this time. Are there other jurisdictions out there, or were we misinformed in Lunsford?
Well, I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. I do know that of the 43 states that were mentioned who allow net worth information, over half of those states have rules with respect to how and when financial information should be discovered.
But you were talking about virtually every other state. I mean, we don't really know that. Is that right?
Well, we do know that the 15 or so states who allow bifurcated trials have rules with respect to when and how net worth information should be disclosed.
Okay.
And most of them say that some prima facie evidence should be made, some prima facie showing should be made before that information is disclosed to the
other. And do they usually withhold it until after the first trial? Or do they generally allow it during discovery after some showing has been made to the court?
Well, there are two schools of thought, actually.
Right now, as I understand it, our second phase of the bifurcated trial is starting up after a brief recess.
Yes, sir.
Which would not be possible.
That's right.
Under one of your alternatives.
Right. Under the New York rule, the information, the financial information, is not even discoverable until after a jury has returned a verdict entitling a plaintiff to punitive damages.
But in the New York rule, you don't really get discovery on the financial, do you?
That's right, Your Honor, you don't. They file a stipulation of net worth or an affidavit of net worth.
On the cases, back when Lunsford was decided, and in fact you refer to a couple of cases that Lunsford actually refers to.
Yes.
Those cases, it seemed to me, decided both the bifurcation and the discovery concerns all at the same time.
Yes.
Particularly the Wyoming case. I mean, it came to the conclusion we're going to bifurcate this, and this is how we're going to handle discovery with regard to that. It seems to me the majority opinion out of this court in Lunsford had that, both that before it. It had the bifurcation question, and it had the discovery question, and it denied the bifurcation, saying we're not going to do that. And it also addressed the discovery issue that we're not going to delay discovery based on some prima facie. Is there any way that this court can accept even your alternative, the Wyoming circumstance, without specifically reversing, overruling Lunsford? Is there any way we can get where you want to go without overruling Lunsford?
Well, Your Honor, in Transportation Insurance Company against Morial, this court held that a bifurcated trial would be allowed when a defendant requested by a proper motion. And that was in part overruled in Lunsford right there. And the only thing about it is, well, Lunsford considered and rejected the Wyoming plan. But the Wyoming plan was in two parts. Now, this court has adopted one part. The part that they haven't adopted is the protection that a litigant needs in order to protect his own private financial information when there is an attack on trying to get that information from him. And that's what this addresses. So part of that was already done in Morial.
But one of the problems, though, that's presented is in Lunsford, the specific question was whether or not the specific question is you're going to get this discovery, and our particular rules do not permit the requesting of a prima facie showing for what permits you to go look at or for punitive damages for this admissibility of the punitive. So in Lunsford, this court actually held that our rules, as they're written, do not permit this kind of request for a prima facie showing.
That's correct.
That's pretty strong language in Lunsford.
Well, Lunsford, you know, came up on an original proceeding.
I'm aware
of that. Lunsford overturned existing law, Because before that time, Your Honor, network information was not discoverable. So the Supreme Court on mandamus held that network information was discoverable. So the existing law that it came up on, they changed. And so I don't see that this is sort of all that different.
We ought to fix what went wrong last time.
That would be a good way to put it, Your Honor.
So you want us to overrule Lexberg?
Well, I certainly, I wouldn't suggest that you do that, but well, unless there was no other way to get around
well,
it, then perhaps you should, Your Honor.
Suggest that we have to get where you want to go.
Well, no, because the key issue in Lexberg was whether or not net worth information was discoverable, and you wouldn't be overruling that. The rest of it discussed how and when that information should be made available. And I don't know if that was part of the holding or just dicta. But the central holding and the key holding in Lunsford was that net worth is discoverable, which put Texas then in line with, I understand, 43 other states who had allowed it.
Well, enlighten me then, you know, under a non-New York plaintiff, how would you suggest that a plaintiff go about marshaling the evidence to make this showing to the trial judge prior to trial, that it was reasonably likely or possible, or whatever the standard is, that there's going to be a fact issue on punitive damages?
Well, Your Honor, certainly I think that a plaintiff should have the opportunity to make discovery on the issue of gross negligence or malice or whatever issue it is he is attempting to get his punitive damages on. And after he's had that opportunity, sometime close to the end of discovery, but certainly far enough away from trial date, he should have be required to make some prima facie showing through affidavits, much like a summary judgment proceeding, to present to the court the evidence that he has to see if he passes muster on what it takes in order to get gross negligence.
Would the standard be that a trial judge could say at the trial, you've given enough evidence that you're going to get to go to the jury on punitive damages, but not enough that you get this discovery. I mean, there's going to be some gray areas where the trial judge doesn't give it, but then after hearing the evidence, decides that you go to the jury.
Yes.
That's the plaintiff won't have the benefit of this evidence.
Well, that's very true.
And if a trial judge denies this motion, and the evidence doesn't materially change, is that a binding ruling then that there is no evidence of punitive damages sufficient to have the bifurcation?
Well, my thought, Your Honor, is that in order to get the discovery, he should be able to present something to the court that indicates to the court that he may get to the jury on the issue. I wouldn't think that, and if I wouldn't think that that would preclude him from submitting the issue to the jury if something else comes up during the trial of the case that would entitle him to it. But I think that he would get a pretty good indication from the court as to how the court
was can change his mind, either direction. To allow net worth and then say, well, after having actually heard it, there's not enough there.
If you were to recite the facts more favorable to the plaintiff in this case as to their right to discover this information, what would it be? I mean, as I understand the facts, there is no direct relationship between the plaintiff and Perry Holmes. They're a second-hand buyer?
Yes, sir. They're second-hand buyers. There was no communication, and they haven't alleged a specific communication between Perry and the Reves and in the deposition, which is not before the court. But in the deposition, they admitted they hadn't talked to anybody from Perry Homes. It hasn't been alleged that they relied on any advertising material of Perry Homes. And in their depositions, they testified that they did not. So if this sort of...
We're left with a mere allegation of pleading, but not even an allegation of of wrongful conduct.
There are allegations of, well, breach of contract, fraud, misrepresentation, unconscionable conduct, gross negligence. Those allegations are in there. And there are allegations of misrepresentations, but there aren't any specific statements with respect to what took place. The only thing that is stated specifically factually is that Perry built the house, that there were problems with the foundation because of soil conditions. Basically, that's it.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Brent Lemon will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I take issue with counsel as to what the issue is before the court today. The issue is not whether a defendant has to turn over his financial documents. The issue is, did Judge Patterson act in an unreasonable and an arbitrary manner when he ordered that these documents, this information, which is not before the court as far as I know, was not brought up on appeal. I haven't seen anything that shows the in-camera documents are even before the court for the court to look at. But did he act in an arbitrary and unreasonable manner? And I submit that he did not.
That was the identical issue of Lunford versus Morris.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, if you take your defense, two wrongs do not make a right. If the court were tightened up mandamus since that time with the Walker versus Packer case. But even at that point, I think you made a good issue talking about the vehicle. What is the vehicle for this change? If the court wants to change what the rule is, which I submit it doesn't need to, but if it wants to, then perhaps it should go through the committees, I think, as Chief Justice Phillips mentioned in his dissent on the rehearing, is go through the committee. Let the rules committees look at this and talk to people who are actually out there practicing, who actually go through the Morreale bifurcation now and how it works and what the effect would be at that time. What I intend to cover is somewhat the background that Judge Patterson was considering, factual and procedural, and then the practical effect of what we have if what we have now and what would happen if we applied either of these two methods that have been suggested by opposing counsel. First of all, we have Walker versus Packer, of course, which says Judge Patterson had to be arbitrary and he had to be unreasonable in what he did. It's very clear. There's no doubt about that. And in this case, this suit was filed in October of 1994. And I think what we've got here may be the cart before the horse with regard to opposing counsel's argument in that. This suit was filed in October of 94. In the, there was discovery that was seen. At the end of 94, there was an abatement period. In March of 95 is when the objections were filed by the defendants, by Perry Holmes. That was in March of 95. There were a couple of hearings, and in fact there was one hearing on a motion to compel, or on two motions to compel by the plaintiff. In August, there was one hearing, and Judge Patterson said, okay, I want this document submitted to me in camera. And there were other issues that he denied the plaintiff what we were requesting. But he said, I want to take these in camera. Well, 3 weeks later is when we get our first motion to bifurcate this trial. Now, Morreale says you got to file a timely motion to bifurcate the trial. And it's my recollection that's been codified now, and I can't recall the exact time frame, but I don't think 11 months is a timely motion to bifurcate a trial. So even before we get to this hearing where the judge is first considering it, we've got our motion to compel, they haven't asked for a bifurcation. As we sit here today, they've never had a hearing on the bifurcation, nor on their special exceptions. They come in and they say, oh, our special exceptions are going to wipe out their case. They're not going to be able to recover these punitive damages. They'll never get them. There's no way. Well, they don't have a hearing. They haven't asked for a hearing. They haven't written a court and said, give us a hearing on this. We've had two other hearings after the August hearing, and since they filed their special exceptions and their motion bifurcate, we've had two other hearings on these same issues. And at no time has there been a hearing on special exceptions or the bifurcation. So as as this court, I believe, is looking at this case, we don't have a bifurcated case. There's no order that's been entered saying, yeah, we're going to bifurcate it pursuant to Morreale. And if you look at Hines versus Hash, clearly these type of issues can be waived. That, of course, is the case with regard to waiver of the DCPA notice letter.
Is there, under the statute, is there any requirement for the court to have a hearing on a motion to bifurcate?
I don't believe there is. The statute would not apply, I don't believe, because of when this suit was filed. I think the only thing that would apply would be Morreale. And, of course, Morreale came out in June of 94, and it was a year and it was 15 months after that opinion was out. So it wasn't like they didn't know Morreale was in existence. They didn't know they could ask for a bifurcation. So that was in effect at the time, and I think that's what would be controlling. So Judge Patterson has three hearings on this. He takes the argument with no evidence, none whatsoever, presented by the defendants, by Perry Holmes, at any of these three hearings. Not any, not an affidavit, nothing. Now, they did submit an affidavit with regard to other issues we were seeking. We were seeking files with regard to other foundations in the neighborhood. But as to these documents, they didn't submit any evidence. Their only objection is that it isn't relevant and that it was to harass. They never, in their objections, have they ever said, hey, this is private, this is confidential, this is going to embarrass us, this is going to humiliate us, whatever. They didn't. They just said it's not relevant. Well, at that time, it was relevant. And at this time, it is relevant because the case has not been bifurcated. After having these three hearings, after having the documents submitted in camera, after reviewing them, after denying plaintiff's relief on the other, Judge Patterson enters an order saying this information is confidential. You can have it, plaintiff, but it's confidential. So there's a multitude of safeguards involved in this issue. And this is what my practice has shown is the general rule. Whenever a judge, I've never had a judge just say, okay, you got the financial documents. Every time, and I represent both sides, defense and plaintiff, every time you can have financial documents, but it's under order of confidentiality. Or we're going to keep it in camera and you can come up to the courthouse and you can look at it and you can know what's in it, but you can't take it out. You can't disseminate it. Well, you've got the safeguards of contempt. You've got Rule 13. I think that you also have specifically listed in a Lunsford case is the discretion of the judge with regard to whether it's for harassment or an invasion of privacy. The case specifically says we're going to leave that to the trial judge. And I think that was something that was specifically mentioned by Chief Justice Phillips in the dissent in Lunsford on the rehearing was the trial court knows what's going on. He's down there. He's in the trenches. He knows whether it's for harassment. He knows whether it's really private, whether it's going to have any effect on this case or not, and whether it's going to be embarrassing. So I think that in light of what Judge Patterson did, you've got confidentiality, you've got an in-camera inspection, you've got three hearings, and you've got pleadings at the time asserting an allegation for which punitive damages are recoverable, and you don't have a motion for bifurcation to have timely been filed, no hearing having been requested on special exception or bifurcation. The issue is not, do defendants have turned on their financial records? The issue is, considering what Judge Patterson did, what he considered, was that unreasonable, and was it arbitrary?
What is the allegation of the fraud, Mr. Perry Holmes?
The allegation as to fraud is that they knew when they built these houses, they knew that that soil was bad and that they had knowledge that when they built the house, eventually whoever ended up with it, whether it's the first-time buyer or the fifth-time buyer, that they know what's going to happen and the house can fall apart. You've got the Gupta case. You've got all the other cases with regard to the implied warranty also continuing with these homes, with builders, and that's clearly been established.
Could you address the all these other issues aside that you've addressed? Could you talk about the infeasibility or the impracticality of, I believe you alluded to that earlier in your initial response?
Yes, sir. First of all, as I mentioned, the usual practice is that it's going to be held in the confidentiality. The other issue is with regard to insurance companies, which, as the court is well aware, are often the target defendants, and not necessarily in this case, but in other cases, the financial information is on file with the state. It's always on file with the state. You can always get a certified copy there. But the practicality problem that you run into, with an insurance company, you can get a certified copy of this document, then you can offer it in evidence, and you can depose people, and you can ask, you know, is this accurate, et cetera, et cetera. If you go with what is being discussed, one, you're not going to have an opportunity to try and settle the case. The court doesn't live in a vacuum, and I'm sure the court is aware that if there is a lot of money out there for a defendant, it will have a different effect on your case as to whether the defendant has zero money. And while that is not admissible, of course, you've got insurance. And the rules provide, of course, that you can get the information with regard to insurance. And I think there's an analogy there that as a plaintiff's attorney, I'm looking to see what my final recovery can be in a case. I've had cases before. You find out the net worth, and then, you know, your case is not pursued quite as vigorously, and you can resolve it. Whereas
you raise an interesting question or interesting issue. If the judgment's going to be paid for by insurance, why would the net worth of the insured be relevant to anything?
Well, in the way the law is, of course, the punitive damage element, one of them, there's seven of them, one of them is net worth. And talking about practicality, and of course, you would put on evidence, maybe you wouldn't. I've had cases before where you specifically decide not to put on the net worth. You know, the defendant, you know, everybody thinks that they're a national company and they're worth a lot of money, and then you find out, hey, they don't really have any net worth. Well, you don't want to put them on. And that leads to another practical problem is when you're doing the voir dire in a case and you're talking about punitive damages and you're seeking punitive damages, you've got to know what's going to be happening when you get down. You've got to have credibility with the jury panel and the jury. When you say, you know, when this is over, we're going to be seeking punitive damages, and then you come back and you see that they don't have net worth. You don't want the jury to know that they only have, you know, a few cents in net value. That's not an element that you want to submit. And what I submit to the panel here is that the plaintiff should not be sandbagged. And the plaintiff should be able to go in with financial documents, one that he can ask deposition questions about and prove up. And I'm not saying just go, you know, on a rabbit, chase every rabbit, but to where he is comfortable that they're accurate. Something that was presented in the Lunsford case, of course, was the definition of net worth. You know, what is net worth? Well, I would submit that on occasion I have had disagreements with opposing counsel as to what net worth is. And the number that the opposing counsel thinks is net worth is not what I'm thinking is net worth. And I don't think that the defendant should be the one who can choose. Okay, you can put this number on. With this depreciation, you're going to have this number, but we're going to use a different method for depreciation here, and you can't put that one on.
Mr. Lemon, let me ask you, I'm not sure if you answered Judge Cornyn's question.
I was working on it, but I hit some of them.
Go ahead and finish answering his question, and I'll get one.
Well, another one is with regard to just the time. When you try a lawsuit, juries get really antsy, as you're probably aware. And if you wait until after you've tried part of your lawsuit, you've got the voir dire problem that I mentioned earlier, then you also have this gap. And there's no way that I can see that in practical terms, you can stop the trial and have them give you a document. You see, for the first time, your case has been pending 3 years, and you get this document, and then you've got 5 minutes to come in and prepare your whole case on punitive damages. That's another practical problem that I've seen. And I think that it would also be the kind of thing to where if you told the jury that, okay, this is a big mega company, and then you didn't put it on, you're going to really, really be in some problems. But the time gap to get the jury back in and back going again, because by then you're going to have, if you go under Morreale, I've seen that that's quite a bit of problem there. But the only issue usually is the net worth. And so if your only thing, you say, you come back in, we're going to show you net worth, and then all of a sudden you decide not to use net worth, and they come back in, they're going to be wondering what's going on. So, I'm sorry.
Well, under the statute that we now have, it appears that all the defendant has to do is request a bifurcation, and the trial court's got to grant it, as I read the statute.
Timely.
And it says that the motion is timely if it's made before voir dire. So I guess under the statute, when you come up and you put the jury out there in the panel and the defense lawyer goes up and says, I want bifurcated, the statute says the court shall bifurcate. Under those circumstances, it seems to me that under the new statute, new cases, any rule that would say, well, net worth's not discoverable until after you bifurcate and all that sort of stuff is not necessarily going to be workable. But the Wyoming situation, which says if you're going to allege a claim for punitive damages, that before net worth's discoverable, you have to make a prima facie showing, why wouldn't that be a reasonable solution to both people's circumstances, excepting for the moment that Lunsford specifically says our rules don't provide for that. But why wouldn't it be a reasonable compromise to say, if you're going to seek net worth, then be prepared to do a prima facie. It doesn't depend on whether it's bifurcated. It doesn't depend on whether you have separate trials. It doesn't depend on when the defendant either bifurcates or doesn't bifurcate. If you go in with the notion that I'm going to seek punitive damages, you come in with the anticipation that I'm going to have to make a prima facie showing of entitlement before I can go to the next step of discovery. Why isn't that a workable circumstance?
I think there are at least three problems with that. One is, what is the prima facie showing? How do you tell the trial court this qualifies as a prima facie showing and this doesn't qualify as a prima facie showing? Two, in Dallas County right now, it takes 3 months to get a hearing in many of the courts. And if you run into having to prove your liability and get enough evidence to prove liability, you may not have a hearing before the trial. I've had that happen on several occasions where we've had issues and we want a hearing and we're 3 months away from trial, both sides, and we just cannot get a trial, cannot get a hearing. So that's another issue. One is that it's just going to increase the workload for the trial court. And then the other is you're going to have a lot more appellate review, I would imagine, because if I go to a judge and I show him what I think is prima facie evidence and the judge says, no, this doesn't qualify, and I need that information, then my only recourse that I could see would be a mandamus type setting, or then having to go all the way through appeal. And of course, that's the type of situation where you wouldn't have all the evidence that you need, I think, to present in an appellate record. The other issue is, I lost my train of thought there.
I'm talking about you need more mandamus probably if the trial judge didn't accept the prima facie showing.
Right. But you'd also have the problem with the settlement. Your possibility for settlement would diminish significantly, I think, when you don't know what's going on financially. But again, I get back to the fact that this, before the court today, is a mandamus proceeding. And whether the court is inclined and thinks that a rule is appropriate to change the method and the timing of discovery, you know, I don't know how the court is inclined, but I do know that this is not the vehicle to do it. To use a term in Lunsford, it would be preposterous to say that Judge Patterson, after having this in camera, the three hearings, the confidentiality, that he acted in an arbitrary and an unreasonable manner.
Judge Patterson may not have thought that Lunsford gave him any choice.
Well, actually, that was my other one. I'm glad you asked that question, because Lunsford does give the other choice. Lunsford says that the trial court is the one who is at the scene, basically. And at the scene, he knows whether it's harassing.
Well, but it was short of that. He may not have thought that, unless he found that he had any choice other than to give it to you immediately.
Well, he didn't. That's what I submit to the court. That is what the law was. How can you say that?
And if it turns out that's not what the law should be, then it's not an abuse of discretion in those terms, but there would never be a change if the issue didn't come up and the court didn't resolve it.
There would never be a change by way of mandamus. there would be a change by way of the rule committee for the rules of procedure, rules of evidence, which I submit is the proper way to do it, because you get so much more input, more than just me up here talking to you or opposing counsel. You've got all the lawyers, all the people on the committee who can talk about these things, who can talk about the practicalities and everything. And so I submit that in fact the rules committee would be the way to change it if the court was inclined to change it. But I don't think that's necessary.
Any other questions? Thank you, Phil.
Marsh, why isn't it preposterous to say that Ms. Patterson abused discretion by following the law? I mean, why is it?
Well, I think mandamus, Your Honor, has been used in the recent past to clarify the law. And a good example of that is National Tank against Brotherton, where the court thought he was following the law when it had to do with privilege, work product privilege, and thought he was following the law when he allowed discovery of an insurance company's file or an investigative file, because he thought that in order to protect a file like that from privilege, there had to be an imminent possibility of litigation. But the court clarified that with on the mandamus or original proceeding. So I think the courts have used it for that reason, or to change the law when the law was needed to be changed. And I think in this instance it clearly does, because not only is there the risk, I know that you mentioned in Walmart against Alexander, another problem with unlimited discovery is the potential for abuse. If all that is required for discovery of sensitive, private, and confidential information in tort actions is a mere assertion of gross negligence in a pleading, needless abuse and harassment could occur. And in fact, Your Honor, that kind of harassment has occurred. And a good example of that is occurring against Gibson, where the plaintiff would try to get everything under the sun, his information on all of his assets, information on his box at the Cowboy Stadium, and this fella wasn't even a defendant. He just happened to own the corporation.
Mr. Marks, what about the argument, though, that the only objection that you have perfected here is one of irrelevancy? In other words, confidentiality is not a perfected objection. So you're asking this court to issue a mandamus for a trial court's failure to rule the proper way on an irrelevancy objection?
Your Honor, we made two objections. We objected on the basis that it was irrelevant and not such that it would lead to the discovery of relevant evidence, and we also objected on the basis that it was harassing. Now, the cases all say that private confidential information, well, financial information is private confidential information. Well, it's harassing to ask for that unless you have some reasonable basis for wanting it. And if you don't have a basis for wanting it, then why get it?
Does the trial court here define what document constitutes net worth?
No, Your Honor. The only thing the trial court said was net worth documents, quote.
What did you give them to look at?
We gave them a balance sheet. We gave the court a balance sheet in
one
camera.
One piece of paper?
Yes.
Is that burdensome to give them one piece of paper?
Well,
that's one of your arguments.
I didn't object on the basis that it was burdensome.
Well,
I objected on the basis
that
it was harassing and on the basis that it was not relevant, or that was the main objection. One piece of paper,
well,
two pieces of paper.
You argued two things here that I think we need to get cleared up. Burdensome was one of your arguments. And the other was that if that information is given to the plaintiffs, it's going to harm them because the competitors will learn about their net worth. But clearly there's an order by the trial court making that confidential and they can't disseminate it to anybody. Correct? Did you ask for the order to be confidential if they turned it over?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so you got what you asked for there.
Yes, but we didn't. We
you just
didn't
don't
ask
want to give it up at all.
Go ahead.
You just don't want to give it up at all.
I don't want to. That's right, Your Honor. And I don't think we should be required to give it up at all. And it's not just that one piece of paper that's involved. They have now sued several Perry entities. And they now have production requests for financial information.
But that's not our record here.
No, it isn't. But it will impact what decision this court makes here today. So there's more out there than simply.
Well, can we make a decision based on something not before us because it might impact? That's a little difficult.
Why does it the confidentiality order or a procedure where the judge keeps it in chambers and can only go up to the courthouse and look at it? Why wouldn't that be adequate protection?
Well, first of all, the court didn't do the latter.
But if they were to do that, why wouldn't that be adequate?
Okay. First of all, Mr. Lemon and Mr. Shaw sue builders on a regular basis. And they have sued Perry before. There's no doubt they're going to sue them again. So there's really no reason why they should have that information in hand, because that information will be available to them in other cases. So I don't think, and once the information is given out, then you can't put the cat back in the bag. The information is out. It's available. And courts have said that this kind of information, once it gets out, the damage is done. You can't undo that damage once it gets out. That would be a good solution, Your Honor, to let them go look at the information in the court's chambers at a time when it became relevant. For example, once the trial, or once they made a determination about what they could see. But the problem I see with that is that if they establish a prima facie case of an entitlement to punitive damages, then they need to have the opportunity to do some discovery. And once they get the information, they should, and I think everybody agrees, they should have some opportunity to do discovery on it if there is not satisfaction with what they've been given.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
All right.